The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jim Cronin from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall be reading to you from the Reader's Digest and Consumer Reports. Okay, let's start off with the food on your plate. I am squash, fall's most versatile pick. It's that time of year, my favorite. Now, when the yellows and browns and oranges of the seasons take their places in the autumnal repertory of jack-o'-lanterns on stoops, gourds on tables, and pumpkin spice lattes warming bellies, I feel very beloved as the fruit playing all the starring roles. But let's get a few things straight, because I can tell you're mildly confused. I see it in your face every year when you learn that the pumpkin in your pumpkin pie isn't what you pictured, but rather honey nut, buttercup, or other squash. I hear it in your voice when you order a squash dish and the waiter brings a plate of zucchini. It is indeed confusing how many types of me have gotten squashed into a single category of fruit that Native Americans called asasasquash. In July, I'm springy zucchini. In fall, I'm an acorn, butternut, and spaghetti squashes, as well as pumpkins, which are great for carving and less great for eating in pie. Leave my winter varieties to dry on the vine and I harden into gourds. It's that last iteration of me that got me where I am now. Most domesticated crops caught humans' attention by being edible, but you took a liking to me because how useful. I was inedible. It's probable that I am the only plant that was used globally by prehistoric people and the first domesticated plant ever. Why? Because dried and hollowed, I contain multitudes. I'm a bucket, a resonating chamber on an instrument, see the marimba and other rattle and shaker since the beginning of time, and a boy on pontoons and fishing nets. I'm a decoration, being carvable, paintable, and fashionable as jewelry. I'm an eating utensil, a pipe, and a cooking pot. Drop hot stones into me, and you can boil water lickety-split. Native Americans use me as birdhouses. Even today, turning me into Purple Martin House is a favorite project for crafty birders. I'm so versatile that whenever people go, I still go with them. Nigerian motorcyclists discovered that what I'm not good for when the country passed a helmet law, and many avoided buying real headgear by wearing gourds instead. I was at last bred to be eaten in Mexico around 9,000 years ago, at which point I made my way back around the world. This time it's food. Making me palatable required breeding out the excesses of cucurbitacin, which gives me a very bitter flavor. I still have traces of the toxin, and while some sources might recount its health benefits, in larger quantities, you humans have actually gotten very sick and lost all of your hair and even died from bitter squash. This is not something you need to worry about when I'm store-bought. The toxin level is high only when accidental cross-pollination with wild gourds takes place. But take note, gardeners, if your freckled fish squash tastes unusually bitter, skip eating me. How should you eat me? Why, all summer long, of course. Pick green and yellow zucchini that are tender and not too big, and consider my lovely yellow-orange blossoms, too, since they're great in quesadilla or stuffed with cheese. And this time of year, avail yourself of winter squash, acorn, butternut, spaghetti, or kabocha, all of which can be eaten with the skin on or off. Acorns, butternuts, and kabochokas can be halved, seeded, roasted till tender, sprinkle sugar on me for a caramelized crust, stuff me the way you French do with a savory bread pudding at the rice and red and meat, and you'll have a beautiful audible centerpiece for your meal. Because I become exceptionally sweet the more I brown and caramelize, don't be afraid of cooking me at the high heat, 425 degrees on an even or even 450 degrees, and don't pull me from it too soon. It's hard to overcook a winter squash. Once I'm soft, then I stay that way, melting and wonderfully tasty. If you're making a soup, roast and brown the squash pieces deeply and puree them for a deeper, bigger sweetness. Oh, and if you spot a green or orange kabocha squash at the farmer's market, snatch it up. It looks vaguely like a pumpkin, but is far more delicious. Less carvable, though, on account of its substantial, carby, sweet flesh. I may be versatile and so forgiving in the kitchen, but let's just be honest. I am not pasta. Those popular zucchini noodles and squash spaghetti are bland and boring. So here's a parting piece of human-friendly advice. Skip the zoodles. Simple, satisfying butternut soup. Peel and seed a large butternut squash. cut it into 2-inch chunks, lightly coat with olive oil and roast on a rimmed baking sheet at 425 degrees Fahrenheit until very tender, about 40 minutes, tossing for even browning. Transfer squash to a large pot or Dutch oven and add enough vegetable or chicken stock, preferably homemade, to cover, about 1 quart. Pour a small amount of hot water stock around the baking sheet and scrape up any brown bits. Add to the pot along with a few sprigs of fresh thyme or sage and simmer for 10 minutes. Remove the herbs, add 2 to 3 tablespoons of butter, and blend until smooth, working with small batches and thinning as you go with stock to reach preferred consistency. Season with salt and pepper, and if desired, cinnamon or nutmeg. Serve with a garnish, a dollop of thick yogurt, sour cream, or spiced whipped cream, crumbled and candied pecans, or frizzled sage and brown butter. Your true stories in 100 words, followed by aliens. The first time I flew, there had been UFO sightings near Green Bay, Wisconsin. My plane made a stop there, and when we were back in the air, I noticed red and green lights following us. After noting this for several minutes, I summoned a flight attendant. I don't want to sound alarmed, but those lights have been following us since Green Bay. She looked out the window, leaned closer to me, and replied, "I hope so. Those are the wing lights." Grandma's slice of love. I spent a lot of my childhood in Grandma's country kitchen. A vintage stove secured one side of the kitchen, while her sparkling countertops were topped by bread boxes that held Little Debbie's and Wonder Bread slices. The most prized possession in her kitchen was her recipe box. A brilliant baker, my grandma cherished the burnished wood box, rim jammed with beloved and secret family recipes, organized into different categories: pies, cakes, cookies, breads, all written in her slanting cursive. Her Formica dinette table provided a glamorous backdrop for her glorious fresh fruit pies: strawberry, rhubarb, blueberry, apple, cherry, the golden crust decorated with pretty S for her name, Shipment. The only demonstrable sign of pride my grandmother ever presented. That tiny kitchen was where my family gathered every Sunday and holiday. But it wasn't just a place to cook. It was a place where she connected our family's past to the present, teaching me our family history through the food she made. Her kitchen is where I shared my life with my grandma, too. After baking, she would always cut every slice of pie, then pour a cup of coffee for herself and a glass of milk for me, and we'd sit and talk at her table. We mostly discussed what I was going to do when I grew up, how I was going to change the world and see places she never had the chance to see. "What do you think Paris is like in the spring?" she'd ask. "Send me a postcard when you go." I was in college when my grandma hosted her last Thanksgiving. I returned home on break and spent most of my time in the kitchen with her, baking the pies for our family, decorating the tops with that signature S. When we finished, she cut 2 slices and poured coffee and milk as always. "Tell me about Chicago," she said, eyes wide and brows resting on her formica table, and elbows resting on her formica table. Every Thanksgiving, I make the treasured desserts from my grandma's recipe box, and after I finish, I still cut 2 slices of pie, pour a cup of coffee for her and a glass of milk for myself, and take a seat at my own kitchen table and tell my grandma all about my life. The operation failed, fortunately. I just awakened after a 12-hour surgery to repair my brain aneurysm. Standing over me, my wife said they couldn't fix it. The brain surgeon next to her replied, "Your aneurysm was too large. We did the best we could. I don't know how much time we bought you, but put the live life to the fullest." Smiling at them, I said, "Well, at least I didn't die." The surgeon grinned. "You just wouldn't die. That was 16 years ago." Pony's first fetch. Puppy's first fetch. My wolfhound puppy was 6 months old and 100 pounds when his trainer taught him to fetch in a large veterinary clinic lobby. The trainer would tell him to get the ball and reward him when he returned with it. He repeated this several times. He then threw the ball 20 feet. It rebounded down a long corridor. The trainer said fetch, and the puppy ran after it, and returned 5 minutes later carrying a walker with 2 tennis balls on its legs. How about a couple of little jokes here? I accidentally threw away my 4-year-old's favorite candy wrapper. Please keep up boasting your thoughts during this difficult time. I held a garage sale with my little blonde Karen Terrier for company. Soon came the first customer. He took his time browsing and examining everything I had out for sale. Eventually, he found something that interested him. "Excuse me," he said, "how much for the dog?" After my 91-year-old mother finished having her hair cut and shaped, the stylist announced, "There, now you look 10 years younger." My mother, unimpressed, replied, "Who wants to look 81 years old anyway?" The nicest places in America. Have you ever noticed that nice people usually travel in groups? Maybe that's because they have a knack for bringing others along, whether it's a simple smile or a great leap that turns a disaster into an opportunity. For our third nicest place to search, we decided to go big. We wanted to find the nicest place not only in America, but in each and every state. And with the help of more than 1,000 nominations, we think we found them. And the nicest place in America is Columbiana, Ohio. No matter how big the need, no one in this joyful Heartland town gets left behind. And they have a picture of the Main Street Theater, which is an old-style movie house. Everyone in Taos knows Ryan Houck, but not for the reasons you'd expect. He's not the businessman who helped revitalize downtown. He's not the bakery owner who donates donuts and hawk bung bones to local fundraisers. He's not the woman who dug into her retirement money to help rebuild Columbiana's beloved Firestone Park. He's just a kid, and he has a lot of challenges. Ryan, 5, has a rare disease called Miller-Dicker syndrome, a devastating developmental brain disorder that makes it impossible for him to speak or move. In fact, the doctor said Ryan wouldn't live long to see age 2. For a long time, his parents, Dan and Megan Houck, were stunned and heartbroken. "All the dreams and aspirations you had for your child kind of vanished," Merrigan said. And they have a picture of the young couple. They're very, very attractive, very good-looking young woman, very good and handsome young man, and their son. Then, when Ryan was 18 months old, the Houcks witnessed what you might call a miracle. It didn't happen all the time in Columbiana. They had heard about the shows at Main Street Theater featuring across actors with all kinds of disabilities, from physical challenges to autism. Curious, they took Ryan to a meeting about the upcoming production of Little Mermaid. Before long, he got a part, a juicy one. He was cast as King Triton, the merman demigod who wields a lightning-shooting trident. This little merman was true family affair. On opening night, Ryan received a personalized star-shaped poster and walked the red carpet, just as all the actors in Crown Theater productions shows do, with his parents. Dan delivered Triton's lines from the wings. Megan, dressed in black to blend in with the background, stood on stage wearing a strap-on baby carrier with Ryan in it. She moved the limbs to as he acted during the lines. When the Houcks finished with their big scene, the crowd jumped to their feet and cheered for the most irresistible theatrical debut in Columbiana history. "It was like watching him hit the home run that we thought we would never get to see," says Megan. "This is our service to the community," says Don Arthurs, who grew up watching movies at the theater in town, then knew back as an adult and now owns and runs the place with his wife, Don Arthurs. "It's our ministry." Columbiana doesn't have an official motto, but if it did, it could well be "No Person Left Behind." Today, an impressive and irrepressible spirit of community infuses this town of 6,200, just as it had for the better part of a century, ever since tire magnate Harvey Firestone donated 52 acres of land to create the Smalling Firestone Park. Time and again, residents come together to boost their neighbors, whether it's volunteering with Project MKC to deliver diapers to needy moms, or donating money to help Columbiana Community Foundation offer more service grants. "A certain moral and ethic and instilled in everyone here from a young age," says the mayor, Brian Blackerman. "It's pay-it-forward mentality. When Jared Chandler and his brothers John and Josh Dunn opened the Birdfish Brewing Company on Main Street almost 5 years ago, they were barely making ends meet and could afford to keep the doors open only 2 days a week. But they wanted to share whatever success they had, so they started Tips for a Cause, a program to donate a day's tips every month to a different charity. The American Cancer Society raised $1,038 the first month. The Akron Children's Hospital recently got a check for $3,779. We opened a business to have fun, and we can help the community too. Why not?" Clownell says. "They don't just donate money. They also give grains left over from the brewing process to Hogan's Baking Company, Owner Sean Hogan then shares the love by giving 1,000 hot dog buns to the annual picnic fundraiser for Heroes and Halos, a nonprofit that supports families with special needs. When asked why he pitches in, Hogan hesitates, almost as if the answer is too obvious to put into words. When there's a need, he says, you help out. Needed is nestled in the green rolling hills of eastern Ohio, about halfway between Cleveland and Pittsburgh. Columbiana is a farm country, mostly cows and chickens, so perhaps it's not surprising that community-minded projects tend to spring up organically, sometimes in the most literal way. Landscaper John Hipley also likes to putter around in his backyard. One year he built an elaborate outdoor train set, complete with tunnels and a water wheel. When a life-size dollhouse, then a children's garden, when giant Monopoly board, a piano you can play by walking on it, like in the movie Big, and a yellow brick road surrounded by the Wizard of Oz characters in honor of his girlfriend, Lynn, who died of cancer. Anyone is welcome to come and hang out. You could even hold your wedding there, free of charge. At the other end of town, and the other end of the helping hand spectrum, is an unusual warehouse. In 1987, a Sunday school teacher named Jim Kochenour Sr. went searching for his alcoholic friend. Kochenour found him in a local dive bar called the Way Station. Along with others in need of counsel, Kochenour became a teetotaling regular, setting up what he called his bar ministry. When the bar shut down, he bought the building that housed it and turned it into a clubhouse of sorts for people to come get sober, with the help of a sympathetic ear. Cheers without the booze. The clubhouse eventually outgrew its original mission, and today the Way Station service included a thrift store, a food pantry, a support group, a treatment facility for teens addicted to drugs and alcohol, and a job center. There's not this "not in my backyard" attitude. People genuinely care, says Vicky Ritterspatch, Kouchenour's daughter, who runs the Way Station. The beauty of Columbiana is that residents band together in good times and in bad. Like so many places in the industrial Midwest, the region has been hit hard by opioids. When the police department lamented that there wasn't enough money in the budget for a canine dog trained to sniff out drugs, the town took all of 2 months to raise $60,000 to buy and train Cowdy, a German Shepherd. Grossout Troop 80919 sold a lot of cookies. Tornadoes, floods, fires, there's never a shortage of people who want to help, says Police Chief Tim Gladys. In fact, we often get more people than we can actually deploy or need. Perhaps Columbiana's greatest symbol of this giving instinct is Firestone Park. Harvey Firestone was born on his granddaughter's farm here in 1868. And while he set up his manufacturing business in Akron, Ohio, he never forgot his hometown. He vacationed here, often with fellow industrialists Henry Ford and Thomas Edison, and in 1933 he donated part of the family homestead to create this oasis. It features a pool and water slide, baseball and ball football fields, a track and walking trails lined with deep brick gutters filled with fresh spring water, relics from the days when folks would water their horses here. This crown jewel had tarnished a bit over the years. Pat Tingle, who was born, raised, and married in Columbiana, noticed the changes in 2000. An educator, he spent most of his adult life moving around the country with her husband, Brad Tingle, an executive with UPS. When Brad retired, there was only one place she wanted to be. My husband said, "Let's go home," Pat says. The Tingles have happily lived in Columbiana for many years, but Brad died in 2014, and their son, David Tingle, passed away 3 years later. When I lost them both, I wanted to do something special for them and something special for the town, Pat says. She cashed in some savings, added much of her husband's life insurance money, and donated her remarkable nest egg, $500,000, to spruce up the family's favorite spots. I always tell people I'm never sorry I came back. There's something very good and solid about Columbiana, Pat says while eating ice cream on one of the new park benches overlooking Mirror Lake, and a plaque that honors her son's memory. You can witness residents doing good to one another, enjoying every minute of it, most vividly at Crown Theater's Troop Special Productions. If you show up for an audition, you get a part, even if they have to add more extras to the cast. Never acted before? No problem. Before Caleb Clappensaddle debuted in Mulan, his only experience in front of a crowd was reading a Mother's Day poem at church and it didn't go well. Caleb, 19, has Asperger's syndrome and often had trouble connecting with others. He just kept his head down and read it as far as he could, says his mother, Carla Capstell. When he finished, he said, I'm never going to talk in front of everybody again. Caleb's sure people would laugh at him when his mother suggested he try out for Mulan. But working with a supportive group that included people with all sorts of challenges has helped him blossom. He's a totally different person, says Carla. It gives him a place where he belongs. He used to not hug, and now he's hugging everybody. Next, Caleb plans to audition for Shrek. In fact, he plans to audition to play Shrek. I get to express how I'm feeling, who I am, he says. Today, Caleb is a star, just like Brian Houck. Meet the judges. Bruce Kelly, editor-in-chief. Madeline Ruggiero, mayor of Knoxville, Tennessee, home of Yasin Fafel House, a 2018 nicest place in America. Sarah Fryer, CEO of Nextdoor, a social network for neighborhoods. Jerry Weiss-Corbley, founder of Good News Network, an online publication that tells positive stories. Gary Dixon, president of the Random Act of Kindness Foundation and the Foundation for a Better Life. David Brooks, op-ed columnist for New York Times and founder of the Aspen Institute's Weave Project, which aims to strengthen America's social fabric. Claire Babineau-Fontenot, CEO of Feeding America, the nation's largest hunger relief organization. Stephen Petro, award-winning journalist and contributing writer on civility issues to the New York Times, USA Today, and Washington Post. Bonnie Kitzer, president and CEO of Trusted Media Brands. The nicest places by numbers. 1,077 nominations were made in response to our call for entries in April. 244 places rose to the top as a team of editors interviewed the field. Then our reporters collected their stories. 50 nicest places, one in each state, received our top honors. 4,559 votes were cast in ReadersDigest.com after we asked Americans to select their favorites. The judges made their top picks, which, along with your votes, fed us in our 2019 Places in America selection. Well, there are quite a bit more to this article, so we're going to wait till next week to finish it off, mainly the rest of the cities for the rest of the 50 states. There's a very important section of Consumer Reports that I'd like to go ahead and do. It's very long as well, so we'll try to get through it today. Welcome to the age of ordinary objects that stealthily spy on us, from inside our cars, our homes, and our offices. That smartphone game you play in a waiting room and mobile apps that gives you a weather forecast, the photo you share with online friends, all have the ability to reveal intimate details about your life. Our increasing digital world has created mountains of data, and there are precious few laws to safeguard the information. But that doesn't mean you can't protect yourself. According to one of three national representative Consumer Reports surveys that guided this special report, 60% of Americans now bar mobile apps from accessing their camera, GPS data, and contact list in their phones, and half protect their online accounts with two-factor authentication. And the pages ahead will provide you with more ways to protect your personal data, and will answer key privacy questions about the technologies from smart speakers to fitness trackers. Here's how to take charge of your digital design. Old school option, the case for a paper password notebook. When it comes to protecting your online and mobile accounts, many security experts recommend a password manager. Software supplied by services such as Dashlane and LastPass or built in popular web browsers can help you to generate and deploy strong passwords across all your devices. But password managers aren't for everyone. Setting it up requires some technical savvy, not to mention a modest investment of time and occasionally money. Chester Wisniewski, a principal research scientist for the cybersecurity firm Sophos, says one old-fashioned alternative can almost be as good, writing down well-crafted passwords on paper, then hiding them away in a safe place at home. The pen and paper method works particularly well for people like Wisniewski's parents, who need only a limited number of passwords for sites such as Amazon, Gmail, and Facebook. The important thing is to never use the same password twice, Wisniewski says. They should also be long and complex. Using a lengthy random string of lowercase letters, uppercase letters, numbers, and characters, such as an aspirand, pound sign, and a dollar sign, keep the notebook in a place where visitors won't see it, and be careful not to lose it. Otherwise, you're looking for a future filled with forgot-by-password requests. Did you use a password manager? 36% say yes. Security experts say that's a wise move, but what's most important is having strong, unique passwords for each account. DuckDuckGo, search savvy. Each time you do a web search using Google, the company archives the details of that search alongside data in your, on your web browsing history to help target you with personalized ads. The company sets serves aside. I'm sorry, I'm having trouble reading this. The print is very poor. The company serves ads to millions of sites, and it can note each time you go to those sites, too. With DuckDuckGo, you can avoid that tracking. The search engine delivers you into the delivers the info you request without building a user profile, generating revenue by showing you ads related only to that single query. Type in women's running shoes and appropriate ads pop up on DuckDuckGo results page and nowhere else. Turn off facial recognition. Facebook says it uses facial recognition to spot fake accounts and to help people tag friends in photos, but never to target users with ads. No matter how it's used, the technology itself can seem intrusive. And Facebook announced in a new setting in late 2017 to let people turn it off. Nearly 18 months later, a CR investigation showed that not all users had received that promised face recognition setting. Our finding was cited by the Federal Trade Commission, who has announced a $5 billion settlement with Facebook this summer. To turn the feature off on all devices via your desktop, click the arrow at the top right of any Facebook page and choose Settings and Face Recognition, Edit, No. Don't have that setting? This works. Go to Settings, Timeline, and Tagging, and who sees tag suggestions? No one. How to search and destroy your old accounts. People have been accumulating online accounts since the days when AOL recruited members using CD-ROMs. Unfortunately, not everyone remembers to delete the accounts they no longer use, and the data in these accounts can expose you to identity theft, phishing scams, and other security threats. Understanding what's out there about you on the Internet is of very importance, says Mecca Hoffman, principal investigator of the cybersecurity firm Spotlight InfoSec. Companies may still be collecting your personal info, and where there's a data breach, attackers can use your login credentials to sign in to that other accounts. So how do you conduct Marie Kondo-style purge? Use these tools and tips to flush out the ghost of Internet posts, then look online for instructions on how to delete them. Email. Search your email accounts, new and old, for phrases such as welcome to, new account, password, and confirm your email to surface these messages you received when you signed up for service. It might be wise to hold on to old email accounts a bit longer, too, in case you need to reset an account password before the purge is complete. Search engines. Type your favorite user names into Bing, DuckDuckGo, and Google to locate profile pages and public posts from your old accounts. The results will vary by search engine, and try hunting for our name and former email addresses, too. Saved logins. If you're allowed your web browser to save usernames and passwords, you can review the archive list to find old accounts. Instructions vary by browser in Chrome, and the most wisely used option. Click on three dots in the upper right-hand corner and go to Settings, Passwords. Google Facebook logins. Any app, website, or game you logged into using Facebook or Google will be listed on those sites. On Facebook, click the triangle on top right of any page and go to Setting, Apps, and Websites. On a Google page, such as Google Search, Gmail, or Calendar, click the grid near the top right corner and go to Account Security Signing In with Google. Specialized research tools. Go to website PWNED, to see whether any of your email addresses or passwords have been exposed to a data breach at a service where you have an account. In addition to reminding you of forgotten accounts, any hit should you to arrange your password. Next, go to KnowHim and NameCheck.com. Sites such as these help entrepreneurs head off trademark problems by revealing whether a potential username has been claimed on a popular platform. That's a great way to learn where your own username appears, too. Smart speakers that listen when they shouldn't. If you own a smart speaker, you should be mindful about internet-connected microphone that lives inside it, according to David Kaufness, Ph.D., an associate professor of computer science at Northeastern University in Boston. How does he know? Well, he and Daniel Dubois, Ph.D., are conducting a privacy study on smart speakers and consulting with CR, and they have some interesting early results. The team started with the leading brand, which setting up four identical Amazon Echo speakers, each programmed to respond to a different wake word, Alexa, Amazon, computer, or Echo. Then they exposed the device to lots of conversation by playing three audiobooks and nine episodes of Super Talky Turn of the Millennium TV show, Gilmore Girls. The results? During the Gilmore Girls marathon, the speakers started recording snippets of dialogue 10 times without hearing the correct woke word. During the audiobook test, the team recorded 63 false positives in 21 hours. Some of the false positives sounded a lot like an official wake word. Others, not so much. There was some good news. When a speaker was fooled into responding to a fake wake word, it stopped recording within seconds. Chofness reports. We called Amazon for an explanation. In rare cases, a spokeswoman said, Echo devices will wake up due to a word in background conversation sounding like Alexa or one of the other available wake words. The company continues to work hard to improve the speaker's performance, she said. Here are bits of dialogue that appeared to trigger the speakers of Chofness things, mistaken for Alexa. I need medical assistance. It's actually I like, plus any words that begin with S, a later, plus another word. Mistaken for Amazon. This is on. It was. There were none. As soon as. Last night. Those were also. Eyes wide. Mistake for computer. Confident. Kiro. Mistake for Echo. Mako, echoing. That's also. We also asked CR staffers and members on our Facebook groups for examples of accidental wake words. Mistakes for Alexa. Election. I like some. Mistaken for Echo. Petco. Pickles. Mistaken for Google. Good girl. Goofball. Mistaken for Siri. Seriously. Hey, Siri. Will you watch what you say around your smartphone? 50% say no. Why not? 32% of those responded that they didn't worry because the speaker listens only if you use the wake-up word. Not true. Encrypted email, Proton Mail. Free email services such as Gmail and Yahoo Mail may soon use your communications for anything from ad targeting to integrating mail with other apps. If that turns you off, consider shifting to ProtonMail. The service offers an end-to-end encryption, which makes the contents off-limits to anyone but you and the recipient. Better yet, ProtonMail doesn't collect data on its users. In fact, you don't need to provide any person's info to register for an account. Drawbacks? The encryption hinders inbox searches. The 500-megabyte storage limit for the free service is low. And if you get your password, you're in trouble. Proton Mail is so hands-off, it can't help you re-access your email. What's the best way to sign in? When you sign up for an app or a web account, it's very tempting to use those big login tools provided by Facebook and Google that enroll you with a single click. But you're better off creating your own username and password. That way you don't have to give Facebook or Google yet another way to monitor what you do online, says Justin Brookman, Director of Consumer Privacy and Technology Policy at CR. Be sure the password you create is strong, Brookman adds. Don't use password 123, and don't recycle one from another account. One argument for continuing on the tech giants for your logins is their world-class security expertise. But there's no such thing as perfect security, says Casey Oppenheim, founder of the security firm Disconnect. Early this year, for example, Facebook discovered that passwords of hundreds of millions of users had been stored and unencrypted on its own servers. When Apple releases its new login feature this fall, though, Oppenheimer says it may be worth reconsidering its advice, at least from a security point of view. The feature, Sign In with Apple, which, much like Google Login, operates independently of the company's password manager, protects your email address by using your Apple ID instead. It uses Face ID or Touch ID for two-factor authentication. and it can generate random email addresses for new accounts that you simply delete if the accounts flood your inbox with spam. The idea is frankly awesome, Oppenheim says, but much depends on the real-world details. The jury is still out. Do you use Facebook or Gaggle to sign into other accounts? Americans who have accounts on those platforms are almost evenly split on the question. Privacy and security experts say it's better to create individual logins for each account you use. Facebook, 6% always, 44% sometimes, never 51%. Google, 6% always, 45% sometimes, and 46% never. How to delete Alexa recordings. Amazon, Apple, and Google have at times had humans review a bit of dialogue recorded by their smart speakers to improve their voice computing technology. To delete select recordings and place limits on the use of such data, you have to dip into the settings on the device mobile app. But Amazon recently made things slightly easier with two new voice commands. Alexa, delete what I just said, and Alexa, delete everything I said today. Before you can use the feature, though, you have to activate it. On the Alexa app, tap the three bars in the upper left and choose Settings, Alexa Privacy, Review Voice, and History, and flip the toggle switch to enable the deletion by voice. Pressing question. Is public Wi-Fi still dangerous? You've probably read the advice countless times we've given it ourselves. Don't use the Wi-Fi coffee shops, airports, and other public places, especially for sensitive activities, such as checking a bank balance. But those worries outdated? These days, most websites use encryption to protect information as it travels back and forth between your devices and the web. Whenever you check email, shop on Amazon, or read an article on the Consumer Reports website, you see a little lock symbol and HTTPS in the address of your browser, indicating that encryption is at work scrambling the data transit. Even if hackers intercept it on email, they will be hard-pressed to decipher it, what it says. Does that make Wi-Fi a danger-free zone? Not quite, says Gary Davis, chief consumer security evangelist for the antivirus software maker McAfee. Things are much safer now, he explains, but that doesn't mean all threats have gone away. First, PDFs of medical records, bank statements, and so on are transmitted in an unscrambled format. Second, there is no way to see whether most mobile apps employ HTTPS. And finally, encryption isn't always deployed correctly. One study conducted by researchers in Europe concluded that security of a significant number of websites had been severely harmed by cryptographic weaknesses. How to stay safe? Many tech savvy folks connect to the Internet using secure VPN, virtual private network app, but you also might try using cellular connection, because cellular signals are less likely to get Wi-Fi to get hacked. That's easy to do on a phone. Just don't join the public Wi-Fi network if you're using a laptop or tablet. You can set up your phone as a Wi-Fi hotspot, although access to that feature depends on your cellular plan. This will burn through some data. It might also leave you with a slow connection. Or you could just use the Wi-Fi and stay off sensitive sites. Will I log into my bank account on Starbucks Wi-Fi? Asked creator Wisniewski of the cybersecurity firm Sophos. No, but I will log on to Twitter. Will I log on to Twitter? Sure. Limit GPS tracking. The apps on your smartphones don't need to know where you are at all times, especially when you're not looking for a traffic report, weather forecast, or dining hotspot. Here's how to limit access to your phone's GPS data. Apps may still use Wi-Fi signals and other clues to infer your location, but the data is typically less precise. While you're at it, you can use these settings to control access to your contacts and phone library, too. On an iPhone, go to Settings, Privacy, Location Services, then toggle the control off to stop GPS data from being transmitted. Or the tap on each app individually can control which one get access, always, never, or while you're using the app. On an Android phone, go to Settings, Google Location, and flip the toggle switch or scroll down to App Level Permission. What's your info sells for on the dark web? Data stolen by hackers is often sold through online forums on the dark web. Here's what personal info is worth, according to Emily Wilson, Vice President of Research at the security firm Terry Beam Labs. Login credentials. Price, a few dollars. Username and password combinations for email, music, streaming, and retail accounts aren't worth as much as you might expect, Wilson says. Criminals will often dump lists with tens of thousands of entries into the Internet, driving prices down. Credit card info. Tens of millions of credit card numbers are for sale online, Wilson says. The vast supply, plus the fact the numbers from old data breaches might be no longer be valid, can limit the price to 50 cents apiece. But the price for a card with the right credit limit, think American Express Centurion card, can stretch into the hundreds. FulzData, that's F-U-L-L-Z, data, FulzData, a complete digital profile, name, date of birth, billing address, and social security number, opens the door for identity theft. A standard kit can cost anywhere from 50 cents to $50, Wilson says, but an infant's profile can claim $300 because the fraud it enables can go undetected for decades. The spy in your pocket. You're sitting in the kitchen with your spouse, chatting about island getaways, and a minute later, an ad for the Bahamas cruise pops up on Facebook. Such incidents have you convinced your phone is listening to you. You're not alone. But surprise, security experts say you're not entirely correct. You're right to think the technology industry is keeping close tabs on you, just not with your phone's mic. Research is led by Northwestern University Associate Professor David Chaffness, Ph.D., analyzed more than 17,000 widely used apps on the Android operating system and didn't find a single instance where the app activated a phone's microphone and leaked audio data without permission. WonderEra, a mobile security company, performed a similar study focused on high-profile apps such as Amazon, Chrome, Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube, and just like Chaffness learned, it found no evidence of secret recordings. The researchers weren't surprised. Chaffness says that the speech-to-text translation required to mine that audio data is relatively poor in quality. It's just not an effective way to spy on people compared to the extensive web and mobile app tracking ecosystems put in place by major tech platforms, advertisers, and data browsers. So what's not really going on? People underestimate just how much data companies such as Google collect through methods having nothing to do with microphones, says Clay Miller, Chief Technology Officer for the mobile security firm SyncDog. The sites you visit, the products you buy or simply read about, the places you live, work, and travel, and other personal details can help marketers decide precisely which ads to show you, especially when they can compare the data with the information on tens of millions of other people. At times, the process can seem like magic. Not that apps don't do some dodgy things. For instance, the Northeastern study found about 9,000 apps with the potential to take and transmit screenshots of the app in use on a person's phone, potentially recording information as it's being entered and sharing it with third parties. For what it's worth, mobile data often suck up GPS and other contactless data. 2. To reduce such privacy intrusions, take a moment to read the permission before installing an app. Review those permissions on your phone every now and then, and avoid using Facebook and Google login features. Android versus Apple, a tale of two phones. Smartphones collect all sorts of info about us, even when we were not using them. In 2018, Douglas C. Schmidt, computer science professor at Vanderbilt University in Nashville, Tennessee, set out to see how often Android phones and iPhones quietly sent data back to the servers of their respective motherships. The results may surprise you. In a typical gig, Google servers requested info from an Android phone 90.3 times per hour. Apple servers, a less frequent, 17.9 times per hour. Charted below is the volume data relayed by each phone in the 24-hour stretch, including the approximate amounts used for location tracking and interactive. And here's the Android, 11.8 megabytes per day, and Apple only 1.4 megabytes per day. Android has location data. That was total data. Location data, Android 3.0 megabytes per day, and 0.07 megabytes per day for Apple. And advertising-related data, 4.06 megabytes per day for Android and 0 megabytes per day for Apple. The right to remain private. where federal law lets you down. There are shockingly few legal privacy protections in the United States, says Marie Mahoney, a policy analyst at Consumer Reports. No federal law provides the kind of broad consumer rights granted in 2018 by the European Union's General Data Protection Regulation. However, scandals involving Facebook, Google, and other tech giants are helping to raise interest in such legislation. For instance, 63% of Facebook users say the company shouldn't be allowed to collect data on them when they're not using Facebook, according to a January 2019 CR nationally representative survey of more than 2,000 U.S. adults. We still have a long way to go nationally, Mahoney says, but a number of state legislatures have stepped up and increased past privacy laws of their own. For the following national laws provide more protection for consumers. The Federal Trade Commission Act. This law prohibits unfair or deceptive business practices. That means companies are prohibited from making misleading statements about how they handle your data. However, as long as they adhere to the terms in the privacy policies and user agreements, which can be vague and filled with jargon, the companies are mostly free to collect and use information as they fit. It wasn't the voluminous data gathering or the way information was shared that led to Facebook's recent $5 billion settlement with the FTC. It was the misleading statements the company made about the control that consumers had over that personal information. Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act. HIPAA limits what healthcare providers can do with your medical data, preventing doctors, insurance companies, and billing firms from disclosing that info without permission. But it does not necessarily protect info collected by a smartwatch, reproductive health app, or direct-to-consumer genetic testing service. Unless the info ends up as a healthcare provider's files, it has the same limited protection as other data about you. Children's Online Privacy Protection Act. COPPA requires companies to get verifiable parent consent before collecting from children younger than 13. Firms may also explain how the data might be used properly, secure the information, and provide parents with the means to delete it. Yet once consent is granted, such data is fair game, albeit generally off-limits to third parties. The problem is, digital toys and apps often useless without a quick sign-off. Additionally, YouTube has been accused of violating COPPA. Despite its many child-oriented videos, YouTube says it serves a service that the site is intended for teens and adults. Yeah, right. These states are pressing ahead with laws that could become models for national legislation. California. The California Consumer Privacy Act is on track becoming the country's most sweeping privacy law when it takes effect January 1st. The law gives consumers the right to access, delete, and opt out of any out of the data of the sale of personal data. Illinois, the Biometric Information Privacy Act, passed in 2008, governs companies that collect and use fingerprints and facial recognition data. Amazon, Facebook, Google, and Six Flags have all been sued over alleged violations. Texas and Westinghouse have similar laws, minus the individual right to sue. Maine. The Act to Protect Privacy Online, Customer Information signed into law this year places new restrictions on the state's Internet service providers. They generally can't use or sell residents' personal information unless the customer opts in, and they can't charge people more for refusing. Oregon, HB 2395 mandates reasonable security features for most products that connect to the web. That can include supplying unique passwords or requiring users to create one, practices that can help prevent malicious strangers from hijacking baby monitors and home security cameras. Vermont, Act 171 of 2018 is the country's only law to specifically require data brokers, those companies that statistically stealthily collect and monetize people's personal information. The firms are required to register with the state and provide annual updates on other business practices. Advanced advice, privacy tips that need more explaining. We love tips and tricks for protecting your privacy. There are many of these pages, but some widely suggested techniques don't do as much as you might think. Secret password code. Strong passwords are hard to remember. That's why many people try tactics such as taking a familiar word and replacing the A's with amperands and E's with threes. But these days, criminals have software capable of beating those kinds of ploys. The best passwords are long, random strings of letters, numbers, and special characters. Fake social media names. A clever online pseudonym may protect you from the prying eyes of friends, family, and some data collectors. But it doesn't throw companies such as Google off your trail. They use digitally breadcrumbs, email addresses, phone numbers, Wi-Fi network locations, and ID numbers tied to your devices to keep track of who you are and what you're doing online. That's scary. Incognito mode. The incognito or private mode on your web browser can hide your online behavior from other people who use your computer. It may also stop companies from storing trackers such as cookies on your laptop. But it won't necessarily conceal your identity, location, or activity from your internet service provider or a website you visit. Should I use a workplace Fitbit? We asked Dana P. Medelson, Senior Policy Counsel at Consumer Reports, here's what she says. Some people may find company-sponsored Fitbit trackers to be a helpful way to improve their fitness goals. But keep in mind that the information collected by trackers, as well as health-related tech problems, such as a home blood pressure monitor, smart scales, and health apps, is not automatically protected by U.S. privacy laws, even if the device is used for medical reasons. The data in fitness trackers does not qualify as health information. If I track my weight on an app, that's not health information. To be protected by the Health Insurance Portability Act and Accountability Act, that's HIPAA, the information must be created, transmitted, or maintained by a HIPAA-covered entity, such as a healthcare provider or insurer or data clearinghouse responsible for billing. Such gluing up any health data in a wellness program, ask who will see the information and whether it might be shared with others. If your company's program is run by an insurance provider, HIPAA may apply. But if the program is run by a third-party company that's not HIPAA-covered, it may not. It can get pretty confusing. For instance, if Aetna gives me a tracker and I use it, the data generated is generally not HIPAA-protected until the information goes back to Aetna as included in Aetna's records for me. Then it does fall under HIPAA. In short, there's no clear way to average person to know what the protections apply and when. That's why Consumer Reports wants to see a law passed to take away the guesswork. Enable two-factor authentication. What best describes your use of 2FA? 39% say, what's that? Yet this common setting is crucial for online security, according to experts. Security experts say everyone should use multi-factor authentication when it's offered to protect important online accounts. The goal is to block hackers from gaining access even if they've acquired your password. Once you turn on a company's 2FA setting, you'll need to provide info in addition to the password anytime you try to access the account from an unverified location or device. Typically, the company will send you a verification code by text or via an app. Without the second identifier, hackers armed with a stolen password get blocked. Setting up 2FA is usually easy. As an example, for your Google account, you go to Gmail inbox or any other Google page, then click the grid icon in the top right and go to Account. You may need to sign in first. Security two-step verification. Get started. The oversharing camera. When you take a snapshot with a digital camera, including the one on your smartphone, the device captures data about where, when, and how the image was recorded. And when you share that picture with someone else, that information, called exit data, typically goes along for the ride. That's how mobile apps and storage devices such as Google Photos and iCloud Photos know how to sort your Springsteen summer tour pictures by place and date. Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and other sites hide the data from the public, but they reserve the right to use it themselves to enhance their services. People should be aware that when they upload a photo, there is more than just the pixels they share, says University of California, Berkeley computer science professor Henry Farid, a leading researcher on digital forensics. Imagine, for instance, that a private investigator, savvy thief, or the stalker could learn about your weekly routine simply by using the exit data in your phone archives. Most smartphones don't have built-in tools for removing the data, but free apps for Android and Apple phones can help you do it. If you are really worried, just take a screenshot of the photo and share that instead, says Bobby Richter, who oversees privacy and security testing of CR. Screenshots typically don't include some smaller sensor metadata such as photos from a camera. For some people, though, the only bit of exit data that feels too personal is the info of where the photo was taken. That's a pretty serious privacy issue, Ford says. You know where those in the picture are at any given time of day. If you want to keep that location information out of your image, simply revoke the camera's app's access to GPS function on your device. In iOS, go to Settings, Privacy, Location Services, Camera, Never. Instructions for Android devices may vary by model, but typically you need to open Settings, Lock Screen and Security, Location, App Level Permissions, and switch the toggle off for Camera. On certain Android devices, camera apps have their own GPS settings. To strip out the location data from photos stored on your computer, do the following. In Windows, right-click on the image file, then Properties, Remove Properties, and Personal Information. In Mac OS, open the photo in Preview, then Tools, Show Inspector, and Remove Location Data. Well, we have a couple minutes left, so let's do a little laughter, the best medicine. As a customer approaches the general store, he notices a large sign on the door, Danger, Beware of Dog. He carefully enters the store, but once inside, all he sees is a fat old hound asleep on the floor. Is that the dogs you're supposed to be beware of? He asks the store owner. Yep, that's him, the owner says. He doesn't look dangerous to me. Why would you post the sign? Because, says the owner, before I posted that sign, people kept tripping over him. What do you call a lazy David kangaroo? A pouch potato. Oh, that's awful. Librarian humorist Roz Warren took to Facebook to ask her librarian friends a question. If they died and were sent to Hades, which would the discounted at just one book available to read, what would it be? Here's the literature worthy of Satan's bookshelf. The manual to our office phone system. Dante's Inferno would be like having a Fromer's Guide. The second book in a trilogy. Brimstone for Dummies. My Ex's Diary. The Bible so I could look for loopholes. A plumber fixes a leak in a doctor's house, then bills him for $1,000. This is ridiculous, the doctor says. I don't even charge that much. The plumber says, neither did I when I was a doctor. Thanksgiving joke to share between courses. What's the smallest unit of measurement in the Pilgrim Cookbook? A pilgram. What do you call an evil turkey? Poltergeist. What kind of tan did pilgrims get at the beach? A puritan. And with that, we have just about run out of time for today's episode of the Reader's Digest and Consumer Reports. Be sure to listen in next time. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast on our website, NorthCarolinaNCReadingService.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. I'm Jim Cronin, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. So long until next time, and thanks so very much for listening.